on tour.
Oh, the tour has been excellent. You know, it's been a growing journey for everybody, I can say.
I feel like I've been having epiphanies every day.
We've gotten to know each other quite well, I'd say. I mean, it really has become a traveling circus family.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Another way to help us bring you the news is donate a vehicle you don't need. Car, truck, motorcycle, you can donate to this station and it could mean hundreds of dollars of support. Thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not. Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
Jimmy Kimmel Live is no more.
It's an Occam's razor situation. It's exactly what it looks like.
What it looks like is a steaming soup of government intimidation spiced with gobs of media consolidation. A toxic brew.
Nexstar has pending business before the government. Tegna also does. And there's another big station owner called Sinclair that also has business pending before the government.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm Donna Fellenberg. You know, people have asked me on more than one occasion how I select my guests. So here's one example. I'd often seen this particular woman at different events. She wasn't hard to spot. She was always perfectly put together, her long blonde hair expertly coiffed. She had an almost incandescent air, I would say, about her, like she was from another time. This is born out of nothing more than my visual impression, not having known or spoken to her ever. Then one day at a Yarnslingers performance, I did hear her voice, and it did not match her appearance. It was a husky voice on the verge of being a bit loud, but not actually too loud. It had authority. And then to top it off, I learned that, one, she was the mother of the incredibly talented humorist Kiki Reginato, and two, her name was Felicia Deschambres. What? I was already intrigued. And then I heard, after a little snooping, that she was a ceramic sculptor. I decided to contact her. So, this is how it happens sometimes. I get an instinct about a possible guest. But the story of Felicia's life was nothing like I could have imagined or heard before. And fortunately for you, dear listener, I'm about to share it with you. Here we go. Felicia, you were born in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and you told me that you moved around frequently due to your charismatic father's colorful, shall we say, business dealings.
Yes, I was born in Calgary, and we moved around a lot. My father was a, there was really nothing else to call him except for a white-collar criminal. So we were always just a little bit ahead of the law.
Okay. Well, actually, your parents came from very different backgrounds. Your mother, who was a Broadway actress, Jan Sherwood, of course, I Googled her, and there's a lot there. Well, she has ancestors going back to the founding fathers and daughters of the American Revolution. Now, your father comes from completely different lineage.
Yes. He wasn't an immigrant, but his grandparents were. His mother moved here from Vienna, Austria when she was two. They had nothing. He was working, sewing fur coats together in a factory by the time he was 13 or 14 for probably God knows how many hours child labor a day. Oh, I don't think he felt like he had the luxury of a moral consciousness, let's say.
Interesting. Yeah, he didn't have the luxury of that.
I think he felt like it was a hard scrabble life and you did what you could to survive and get ahead. And he leaned towards taking advantage of this, whatever system he could take advantage of. And, you know, he did it very successfully. He made a lot of money doing it.
Yeah, we're going to hear about some of the lifestyles that you became accustomed to as a child in a few minutes. One of the stories you told me from your childhood was when you lived in Jamaica on a yacht. I'm sure the listener would love to hear about that.
So we had moved from Canada down to Jamaica, and we had a 150-foot yacht with a 14-man crew. It was too large to dock in the yacht club, so we were confined to the port. I never slept. I never took naps. So when my siblings would be napping, I would be creeping around below deck. I don't know where my mother was. And I would creep around and I would watch this man. He had no legs. And my mother would allow him to dive for corals off the side of the boat. So he would go down, he would hold his breath. I would try to hold my breath for as long as he held his breath. And then he would come up and he would have all this coral. After we moved from Jamaica, a story came out that he was actually diving for gold in sunken ships. And he had accumulated quite a bit of gold off of those sunken ships. But the Jamaican government had, you know, intervened and caught him. And anyway, my memory is just watching this legless man jump in and my mother's centerpieces with all this coral, this gorgeous coral in them.
Well, that is so interesting, isn't it? Because very much like your father, he had to overcome an obstacle. He didn't have any legs, and he just did what he had to do.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Taught himself to dive, and he just did what he had to do. And then your mother had these corals in your house that, you know, probably looked like she had paid thousands of dollars for them, and she actually got them right from the ocean.
Yes, yes.
Amazing. Well, you did meet some interesting characters in Jamaica, and that's quite a story. Do you remember any others from those days?
Not really. I was very young in Jamaica. Yeah. I remember walking into Kingston with the woman who took care of me and my sister, and walking in, the grasses were above our heads. I don't remember very much from the time in I stepped on a rusty nail one time, and the little children whose parents worked on the ships that were docked in the port, which is where we were docked, threw me into the water because that's how they clean their wounds in salt water. So they tossed me in, and at first I was terrified, and then they thought I was fine. But of course, I had to be taken in for tetanus shot.
I think something happened in Jamaica, and you then set sail for the Bahamas, and you lived for a time there. Your father continued his ways, you know, what he did, which included living the life of royalty at some point. Would you tell us about living in England?
Before we moved to England, although he spent most of his time in Europe, we lived in Miami. And at some point, for whatever reason, and he didn't tell us because he said he inherited it, but it was pretty clear to me, even as a child, I thought, this is absurd. I don't think so. But he bought a title. I was 11 or 12 years old, I think.
I had no idea you could buy a title.
Nor did I for a long time, but apparently it was a thing if you had enough money. We were living in Howard Hughes's house. One of Howard Hughes' house. He had five in Miami Beach, and we were in Miami Beach living in one of his houses. It was a very elaborate house. We bought it furnished from the estate. My father bought this title, which was Baron de Mornay, Duc de Vatan, and Prince de Chabris, and he decided we would use the name de Chabris, because of course he wanted to be a prince rather than a duke or a baron. So then our names changed. I think it was probably because his name was Marx. And at the time, you couldn't get into a lot of country clubs in Miami if your name was Jewish. So he didn't want to be thrown under that umbrella, and he chose to find another path. Or he wanted to change his name for business reasons. I really have no idea. But he really did enjoy this. Went to Rome. They gave him the title in the Vatican. My mother went. My half-sister went. It was a whole ceremony. It came with a crest. It came with everything. And then when we moved to the UK, which was only, I don't know, a couple of years later, we just started anew with this new name, and we started our lives anew.
Unbelievable. Does that make you a princess?
Indeed, it does. Serene Highness, in fact.
Serene Highness. Well, you must have had some fun times with that, or did you not bother?
It was sort of absurd. It was in the local papers. Everybody thought it was real. As a kid, I was called Boo. So I went from being Boo Marx to Felicia de Chabris, this unfamiliar name completely to me. So Felicia de Chabris, Boo Marx, and suddenly I'm in this boarding school in England and everybody's calling me Felicia de Chabris. And actually, it happened before I left, and I was in an all-girls private school in Coconut Grove in Miami. And they would bow to me in the hallways. It was embarrassing.
Oh.
It was embarrassing at first to have this sudden transition. But then when we went to England, nobody knew. So, mm-hmm.
Well, do you feel like you've grown into your title
Well, I feel like if my father paid all that money to call Dishabri, why wouldn't I be?
Well, I love your name. I think it's beautiful.
Thank you so much. He was illegitimate, so he had no real last name. And I think that was part of his motivation.
Yeah, makes sense. So Miami was very important on a number of levels, but I think that's where you met your soon-to-be husband, who was a sculptor who actually lived in Soho. And he convinced you to go to New York City with him. Is that when you became aware of your own artistic inclinations, or was that something that you always knew about yourself?
It was something I always knew about myself, having been a severe dyslexic. I didn't really imagine that anything more that involved writing. I also had a somewhat natural talent for it. I would say both of my parents also had a very natural talent for the arts, for drawing. They could both draw. My mother did caricatures, and she had many of them published. So I think that there was some just automatic understanding that I would be able to draw. And I did. I was able to draw, and I went to art college in the UK. And then when I moved on to go to, an art college in Miami. So I went back and forth from boarding school and starting college in England and then coming back to the States, back to Miami, and finishing and getting a degree in interior design. So I would have a profession that I could use my artistic talent at. But yes, I always thought that I would be an artist. I never considered doing anything else. I mean, an artist, meaning I'd be an interior designer and I'd probably do some art on the side, is what I imagined for myself.
Well, eventually your ex-husband built you a studio and your career as an artist kind of took off quickly. Isn't that true?
Yes, I moved in with him quickly. and I loved New York and I loved living in Soho in the 80s and 90s. It was, it was really a fun place to live. It wasn't a shopping center at the time. It was truly a place where there were a lot of artists. The East Village was kind of where everybody was moving then, but there were so many artists in Soho and it was so fun. So what happened was I moved in with him. I didn't really think it was possible to make a living as an artist, but he made a living as an artist. And I was helping him. So the first few years I got him a Guggenheim, I got him an NEA grant, and he went, wow, you can do this. Don't go to work. I was thinking I would go to try to find some work as an interior designer in New York, but I didn't. And then he built me a studio, yes, in the loft, which was 5,000 square feet. So there's plenty of room, even though he was a sculptor, big steel sculpture. So, his work took up much of the space, but yes, I had a nice little studio there and I started making my own work, and galleries and people who came by to see his work would say, oh, Felicia, why don't you send us a couple of pieces? I'll take that one and that one. And I would do that. So I started sending pieces to galleries randomly and they sold them. So that's how I got started.
Yeah. Your life has a little bit of magic in it, don't you think?
Thank you for saying so. I don't know how, because I've only lived my life, so I don't know how it compares to other lives.
Well, that's how I see it. And it's really quite a story. I think we'll take a break here and return, and then we'll hear the next chapter.
All right.
You've been listening to Catskill Character on Radio Catskill with me, your host, Donna Fellenberg, and my guest, Felicia Dishabri of Eldred, New York. We'll be right back.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Brian Babylon didn't think the new mascot in New York's anti-phones in schools campaign, Frankie Focus, would be very effective.
I thought Frankie Focus was an Adderall dealer.
I'm Peter Sagal. If you won't put down your phone, then just use it to listen as we go to St. Louis to talk to Cardinals broadcaster Chip Carey on this week's Wait, Wait, the news quiz from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill. Next time on City Arts and Lectures, science writer Mary Roach, the author of Packing for Mars, will talk about her new book,
Replaceable You, Adventures in Human Anatomy. It's a deep dive into our attempts at recreating the human body, told by a science writer known for her sense of humor. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
City Arts and Lectures, Sunday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. If you've just joined us, I'm Donna Fellenberg, speaking today with Eldred, New York resident Felicia D. Chabrie. In the first half of the show, Felicia shared some of her story growing up for a time on a yacht in Jamaica, a manor house in England, and I guess what you would call an unstructured romp in Miami with very unconventional parents. In the second half of the show, Felicia is going to talk about her life as a ceramic sculptor, and she'll perhaps read one of her award-winning poems. Let's get back to it. So Felicia, you took your two kids when you separated from your husband, and it was a while before you got settled. You had had gallery shows and a line in Henri Bendel's, as well as Barney's and the Guggenheim, previous to the separation, but now you needed something more stable. Tell the listener, please, about your next fortuitous move that provided a cushion for you.
Well, after I separated from my husband, my kids were 2 and 5, so the youngest was still bottles and diapers, and I thought I would go on being a ceramic artist. I thought that that was still a possibility. I couldn't entertain the idea that it wasn't. But I had a deal with a magazine called the Art Matters Catalog, and they closed. So I had to scramble and figure out what to do. I got a real estate license, and I had money from a little house I'd had in outside of Bovina. Well, it wasn't really a house. It was a barn, horse and carriage barn. And a couple of commercials that I had done where the residuals were, you know, paid very well and went on for years. So
when you say commercials that you had done, were you an actor in the commercials or behind the scene? What were you doing?
I had a girlfriend who was a very successful actress in New York, and she called me one day and asked me if I wanted to do an audition for a Gerber nursing baby commercial. And I said no. I said no immediately because I didn't want to be an actress. My mother was an actress, and I just didn't want to, I didn't really want to follow in the, I was too much of an introvert to do something like that. I said no. Her agent called me. I said no. It was an open casting call. So they had over 10,000 women. And I thought, what's the point? And I just didn't want to do it. But he said, don't even worry. It's 2 blocks from your house. Just stroll over with your baby, nurse her, and they'll videotape it and, you know, whatever. He talked me into it. I was reluctant. I went over there. I had my thing. I nursed the baby and you know, I never expected anything. I just thought, okay, well, I've done this thing and now nobody's going to be bothering me about it any longer. And lo and behold, we were cast as the mother and baby in this Gerber nursing baby commercial. And it was the Gerber nursing baby commercial that went on from about 1991 to 94. It was the primary commercial you'd ever see on television for Gerber formula. So that was nice. And then I'd done a Merrill Lynch commercial where I was just standing around in a business suit, you know, pretending I was a stockbroker, I guess. Those two commercials gave me a little bit of a nest egg. And I had saved the money in a separate bank account from the ceramics. So that, and since the loft was rent stabilized, and I didn't want any part of that. It was, of course, even though it was rent stabilized, worth a lot of money. I didn't want to change my ex-husband's life more than it would change because we were leaving. So he took that and I took the barn upstate and sold that. So between those things, I was able to buy my first apartment, got renovated, moved to the next thing, got renovated, moved to the next thing. 5 times in 8 years, I moved those kids and got renovated everything. But I was able to be more of a mother than I would have been if I had been working a job and come
yeah.
five. I had my hours were pretty flexible. And the downside was we were often living on construction sites. But yes, yeah, the hours were more flexible. I was more available if there was a parent-teacher meeting. I didn't have to worry about it. And also I was sort of working for myself. And I liked that idea. I didn't really spend much time in my life working for anyone else.
And when did the poetry come along?
So I had a diagnosis of COPD and I was told that I should limit, you know, inhaling any clay dust. So I was trying to make this work with a mask, an inline respirator and gloves and long sleeves. And I love the feel of the clay in my hands. I remember the first time I touched the clay after having raised kids and not having been around clay for so many years. I couldn't stop crying.
Mm.
It was so visceral how deeply I wanted to touch that material again. And so to be separated from the idea of being able to touch it, even though I had the studio and I was working in a way I hadn't worked in the past, and I was only doing what I wanted to do for myself. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I was doing it because it was really nice to get this, you know, acknowledgement that I was talented at making these ceramic sculptures and these galleries and museum shops, and everyone wanted them. You know, the orders never stopped. I had interns from the New School in Parsons. So when I came back to it, I wanted to do things I had never done before. More and more, the natural world had come into my life. I had been living in the city, and now I was spending time with my boyfriend in the Hamptons. I bought the house in Eldred in 2018, and more I was seeing waters and rivers and the seasons changing in a real way, and plants and things dying and living. And I wanted to make forms that were more malleable and had more association with the metamorphosis of change. So I just felt that I wanted things that moved. I wanted movement in my pieces. Before, they had more of a square-like forms, more geometric almost forms. And now I wanted very much more amorphous forms. I really loved working like that. Days would go by. I couldn't stop. And then when I had the restriction of not being able to touch the clay and not being able to see things, you know, I wore goggles, I should say, besides the inline respirator, I was wearing goggles. And it just didn't feel like the same experience any longer. So I separated myself from that. And then out from nowhere, I would just walk down on a beach, and I sat in the dunes, and I just wrote a poem on my phone. I was just sitting there observing, and I don't know, words just came. In Mastope, I had a wonderful little Airbnb on the side of a cliff that looked down on the Delaware, and I sold it, and I was sitting there, and I was moving out of it, and I had gut renovated the place, and I loved it, and there were eagles flying below me. There were clouds below me and above the Delaware, and I was just looking down, and I wrote a poem. I don't know where it came from. I don't know where the ideas came from. You know, I don't know where so much
comes from. Magic.
Yeah, that's magical. So yes, poetry just comes to me. I don't know where it comes from.
And you've had quite a few poems published. You've won awards. I mean, it's not something trivial that you just, let me write a little poem. It's serious. And when I read quite a few of your poems, I thought to myself, this doesn't sound like someone who just started writing poetry and, you know, a couple of years ago. So this sounds like poetry that someone who's been writing poems all of their life has written.
Thank you.
It's really beautiful. So I'd love for you to read one for the listener.
Let's see. On my phone, I can pull up this poem. It's called What If? What if you let all the secrets you were keeping leave your mind like a caged bird, ready to fly, freeing you, freeing her, leaving you behind, instead of staying in the cramped confines where you've kept her all this time? What if the stranger standing next to you at rush hour on the C train on your long ride home randomly hummed your favorite song, and you fell a little bit in love from the Port Authority to Canal Street? What if it were too late and you could no longer ask your mother with dementia all the things you wish you had, preoccupied as once you were, and then she died with everything she had to hide? What if the tree you've touched every day as you've walked by for years and loved because it survived so much destruction, alone, neglected, next to a demolition site, were to hug you back in recognition? What if we walked so long, holding hands and laughing in the rain, that we washed away and were never found or lost again?
What would you like to tell the listener about that poem? And I was wondering how you feel when you're reading it.
You know, these are all experiences I've had.
Yeah.
I have secrets. Everyone has secrets. What would it feel to release them all? Would it feel better? Would it feel less? Would I feel caged? Would I feel not caged? And then I've had experiences on a crowded train where I've heard somebody singing something that I've loved, and I've looked at the person and they've looked at me, and I felt like, this is love. Mm. I love this person in this train singing this, humming this song. And then they get off, or I get off, and it's over. And then there was a tree that I loved. I loved it because trucks would always hit the side of this tree. It had a huge dent in the side of it. I wondered how it could even grow, but it carried on growing. This tree, despite the damage it has, continues to grow. It just made me feel like you could overcome anything. And I've also had the experience of being so happy with someone where you're just laughing and you're having so much fun that if you feel like if you're going to wash away in that moment will be enough. So that's how I felt when I wrote that poem.
Beautiful. I mean, I think people listening can really get that. And it's like you're the tree because you've had a lot of gashes, you know?
I think everyone in life is given their fair share of suffering. And yeah. If they're still here, they've overcome it or they've learned to deal with it in whatever ways they have.
And I loved what you just said about happiness and joy. You know, my new thing is to every day squeeze the joy out of the day and then share it with whoever. And it could be that person on the train.
And you know, you look into a stranger's eyes who's just doing something randomly that he doesn't realize anybody else is even recognizing. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me and saw himself, and I looked at him and I saw myself, and that was enough.
Yeah.
It's a recognition of the universality of life in one another.
Is there anything that you're working on or anything coming up for you, or are you just living your life and squeezing the joy?
Well, I'm doing both, and I'm also back in the studio trying to overcome all the obstacles I have, and I'm making a piece right now. It doesn't matter how long something takes for me now because I don't care. It's not for anyone but myself. So I am working on something that has set my imagination alight, and that brings me joy. And my son is here right now, and of course, you know. Yeah.
Felicia, you are a wonder. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, well, it's been such a pleasure, Donna. Thank you so much.
This has been Catskill Character with today's guest, the artist and poet, Felicia DeChambre. Please tune in every Saturday for more amazing stories from characters of the Catskills and beyond. 10:30, right here on Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks so much for listening.
SUNY Sullivan is now offering the SUNY Impact Foundation's New York State Charitable Tax Credit Program, which makes a powerful difference for students while providing tax benefits to donors. Individuals can make a charitable gift of $10,000 to $100,000 to the SUNY Impact Foundation, designate the funds to benefit SUNY Sullivan, and receive up to an 85% New York State tax credit. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Paid for by SUNY Sullivan.
As the Industrial Revolution took off, weaving became one of Britain's most important industries. Next time on The Wackaload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear songs about weaving and weavers. Join me, please, for Songs About Weaving on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, it's the beauty of bitterness. Not like, you know, feeling sore and aggrieved, but the magic taste that makes chocolate, coffee, beer, and so many delicious things delicious. That, and we take some of your cooking questions coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.